Hey guys, this is Nikhil.
And this is Nick.
And welcome back to Informatonauts.
Episode number 9, almost to the double digits.
Yep.
All right, Nikhil, how are you doing this fine week?
I'm okay. I'm a little stressed out because of finals. But aside from that, I think I'm doing okay.
That's right. Finals are next week. I see you have the finals week beard.
I do. I had the finals beard going.
Quite nice. Now, when I was in undergrad, we had a term for the week before finals. We called it dead week. Is that the same? Did you guys have any colloquial phrases? Or maybe any phrases that you can share over the airways?
We do have dead week. It's just that I don't think dead week exists here at UW.
I don't think so either.
Go straight from the last day of class into finals.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Which I kind of prefer, to be honest with you, because it kind of gives me more time to just sort of be in the flow of things.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to have a week of just screwing around.
Yeah, now what we had was, so dead week was still classes, but there was limits on like the number of assignments and things that they could hand out. Like there couldn't be any quizzes. If you had a test, then that had to be the final. So some classes would have their final like the last day of class.
Oh no, not for, like, I'm taking biostats right now. Mm-hmm. And in biostats, we have a new homework assignment assigned to us. We have a group project that's due on the day the final exam is, mm-hmm. and a final exam to study for.
Yeah, so there was always a debate of whether dead weeks meant like dead as in you had less assignments or dead as in you died that week.
Yeah,
usually it was the latter.
I think it's the latter as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, so we're in the middle of that right now. And of course, I had a buddy from back home in town over last weekend, and so now I'm kind of like, oh my gosh, I have things I have to do. Have like a 12-page paper that's due next Wednesday that I haven't started
mm-hmm.
yet. So of course, everything is due Wednesday. I have two take-home finals that are due on Wednesday, and then this paper. So
for me as well, yeah. I have my final exam on Wednesday morning for stats, and once that's done, I'm going to be a lot less stressed.
Yeah, and then which means that I think we are going out Wednesday night.
Yeah.
I think that's what has to happen, absolutely. So.
Yep.
All right, so Nikhil, what are we going to talk about? What are we going to talk about this week? I know that you, last minute, you added a bunch of stuff, so tell us what's in store for us.
Well, first things first, I ordered a Chemex.
You did order a Chemex.
I did.
All right.
So Chemex is, I remember talking about the AeroPress and how that you kind of make a quick espresso with the AeroPress. But this is a different coffee contraption called a Chemex, which is basically kind of like a flask or a beaker.
Yes, it's very much, it's like a fleeker.
A fleeker, yeah. And you just put like a filter on top of this flask and then you pour hot water over it and you make coffee in that hand-brewed manner. And It has its own advantages and disadvantages, but I went ahead and I bought one because I don't have one and I want to toy around with that. So
did you also pick up a scale?
I did pick up a scale.
Which one?
I can pull up my Amazon.
Did you get the Jennings or did you get the Hario?
I did not get the Hario. The Hario was twice as much as the one I bought.
Yeah. Or did you get the American? Was the American weight one, I believe?
Yes, I think it was the American is what I bought. But
yeah, that's a good one. That's the one my friend Matt has that he uses for his home bar and
It's the American weigh scales.
Great. Now, be careful. I think you have to calibrate. Do you have to calibrate those?
Yes.
Okay.
We do. But that's no big deal. I know how to use a scale.
Yeah. Okay. because the Jennings comes pre-calibrated. So you just fire it up and it's ready to roll. Do I see a hands-free coffee? Is that a blade grinder?
That is a blade grinder I bought as
what?
Well. And it's $20. It's a Hamilton
Beach. Did you buy a blade grinder? Do you know how a blade grinder works?
No.
It's literally like throwing things at a ship propeller.
Yeah.
You bought a blade grinder.
Yes.
Oh. Oh. To use in your Chemex?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
What? No? Is that a rookie mistake?
That's a rookie. Okay, so.
Why? What happened? Explain this to me.
So a blade grinder, literally, it's just like, you remember that? Have you seen that game on, have you ever seen Fruit Ninja on like the Xbox?
Yep.
Yeah, so that's basically what it is. Like, it just tosses the blades at this, like, chop, 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 chop. And it, like, hacks up the blade. But one of the things is because it's, like, it heats up. So it actually starts, like, searing the beans as it whacks them. So it heats up, like, the space. And you have this hot piece of metal that's now coming into contact with your beans. So it starts a little bit roasting them while it's blading. Whereas a burr grinder, which is what I have, it actually has two metal or ceramic burrs. Ceramic are better because they have less wobble and they don't heat up as much.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually it grinds the beans to pieces. Whereas a blade grinder just kind of slices them up. So you get, they call it boulders and sand. So you'll get some that's just like really finely pulverized.
Mm-hmm.
And then some things that are basically just like chunks of bean left in there.
Well, I have a burr grinder, like a hand burr grinder.
Right, your little Hario guy or whatever.
Right, but I don't know. I think I'm gonna give this like blade grinder a shot and see how it turns out.
You know what? This is just added into our America's Coffee test kitchen that we're gonna do. So
yeah, I think a lot of the stuff that people say about, you know, it's just like it's based off of an anecdotal bad experience and they haven't like tested it. And I think if I test it my own way,
okay,
I can dispel a few assumptions and myths.
Boy, I'll have to find this. There was a blade grinder like versus, I mean, I've seen them do blade grinder versus burr grinder, done blind taste tests. One that was really interesting was, so when I was back home, my family does not have any, they have like an awful, awful blade grinder. Mm-hmm. And so I went and bought some, I was going to go buy some nice beans for when I was home. So I went to one of the local roasters. I don't even remember what it's called, but one of our local, Old Crown is the one in Fort Wayne. And so I bought some of their beans and I had them grind it there for me for over the next 3 days, because you get, even grinding on one of their big, you know, industrial burr grinders is better than. And I looked it up, and there was a study that they did, a blind study of blade grinder versus pre-ground burr grinder, and they found that most people preferred the pre-ground stuff, even a couple days off of grind. So
wow, interesting.
So this, but it's fine because we have this now, and so we'll be able to do the full blown test kitchen, which maybe we can try and do maybe over spring break. We can head over and try and do it or something like that.
So I'm actually going to be out of town for most of spring break, but I'll be back next on the 29th, which is a Saturday. Okay.
Yeah, great.
So on Sunday we can totally pull that off.
I'm leaving that Sunday. So damn, or that Saturday night. So anyways, we'll do it and we'll figure all this stuff out. But I'm glad that you got a Chemex. Mine is I'm buying one from a friend that in a metal filter. Mm-hmm. And so I'll pick that up at the end of the month, I think. So I spent a little bit too much money this past week with my buddy in town, so now I have to replenish the dollars for a bit. So
right,
and I just made a big Amazon order and a couple of books, including one on. Have you ever heard of domain specific languages?
I have not.
So just a little bit off topic. So domain specific languages are basically you create a language, a formal commutable language, to address a specific type of issue. So to express things like, they'll use them in embedded systems, they use them in financial trading. Wolfram Alpha, like if you've ever looked at their language.
I love that language.
Right, so that's a lot more general purpose, but that is kind of in between like a general purpose language, which is C, C or Python or Java, which you can do anything that you want, but you might be, if you try to do something very specific, it might be difficult to kind of shoehorn that in there. Mm-hmm. So domain-specific language is a way to, like, you break everything, you take a small subset of what you're trying to do, and you create a specific language that expresses these more complex thoughts or specific topics in a more in-depth way. So I picked up, so I've been looking into this for both some of the work I'm going to be doing over the summer and then possibly some dissertation-type stuff. And going to dig into that a little bit more. So I listened to, there's a great podcast on Software Engineering Radio with one of the guys that, Marcus Volter, I think is his name, one of the European guys that is just like brilliant in this. So it's something I hope we can talk about it a little bit more in the future. So one of the things that comes to mind is, like Jade, like these HTML templating languages. Mm-hmm. It's not quite a totally good analogy, but basically you're saying there's a bunch of code that we need to generate on the back end, this HTML stuff, and we want to create a succinct framework and language kind of for it that abstracts away a lot of that complexity, and you can express using simple concepts. I know if I just use a tab, right, that specifies an additional indent, or just starting a line creates a new div or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it allows you to do additional things like error checking, to be able to say, well, we know that just you tabbed in, but then you started with a wrong class label. And so because we've defined the language, we can actually say, throw that up as an error, either at compile time or while you're actually coding it out and things like that.
I like this. It's a good idea, I think, and it's definitely going to be based off of user-centered design, where you're kind of looking at a group of people and their needs, and you make a language to suit their needs. But in the big picture, it seems like all, you know, every field tends to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And as they grow, they tend to integrate with other fields. So that domain-specific language, although it's sort of made for a certain group, over time, since that group is going to have different, like a set of growing needs,
mm-hmm.
and those needs are going to overlap with a different domain-specific language. So I wonder if in the long run we're going to end up with a generalized language anyway.
Well, I think, again, the idea is that something gets bigger, it becomes more difficult to do. It tries to be all things to all people, and you inherently are making sacrifices. So the example that I like to use is going back to my love of Russian literature. And Tolstoy, when he writes, he'll be writing a scene, and then he'll throw in a French word. And you know, there'll be like in the English translations, there'll be a footnote which you'll go and look at. And so the idea is that his characters, most of them speak Russian, French, and maybe a little bit of English. And so they use French to do... to express, you know, ideas of, like, love or, like, emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in a sense, that Russian can be very more formal and more and less intimate. So he'll switch to another language, in a sense, to get at an emotion or a more succinct idea than what the native language allows him to do. And so, in a sense, when I think of domain-specific languages, I think of stuff along that route of you have something that you want to do, and... you can't do it in a general purpose language, so you move somewhere else to really get at what you're doing quickly and succinctly, and to convey that idea.
That makes sense.
In a simple fashion.
Yeah, I guess if I was going to talk about ice, you know, I could do it in English, but I could also leverage the the Eskimo language, which probably has 22 different descriptions of ice. What I would call ice, they have like several different ways of communicating nuances. So that's a cool idea.
So that's something I hope to be able to kind of dig in over the next couple of weeks, the next quarter, and see what pops out. So anyway, to derail us from our cool Amazon purchases. So
cool.
But yeah, but I do want to talk a little bit about while we're sitting right here. I had a buddy in town this past week, mm-hmm. and one of the things that, and I had another friend who her father was in town, and we were talking about, what do you do with somebody when they come to Seattle? So if you had somebody coming to visit you, what would you do? What would you do with them?
Oh man, you know, there are a few, I guess, essential sightseeing places that you could go to, like the Space Needle, or mm-hmm. There are a few museums like the SAM, which is mm-hmm. the Seattle Art Museum, or the EMP Museum.
The Experience Music Project.
Right, right. And then there's a number of landmarks like the Public Market and mm-hmm. things like that.
And the Troll, of course.
Exactly, the Troll under the bridge. But my favorite, what I love taking people on is the Seattle Underground Tour.
Oh, yeah.
It's a lot of, you can get a quick history tour of all of Seattle, and or at least the downtown Seattle. Because I guess Seattle was actually, the original version of Seattle was built underground. Like, what is underground today? The sewer system
mm-hmm.
is what Seattle was. And then at some point we had a flood and an earthquake or whatever it was. I've already forgotten what they told us in the tour. But we rebuilt Seattle on top of that old version of Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see that and actually walk down there into those kind of
mm-hmm.
cave-like areas and see old shops from the Wild West
that
are still there.
Yeah, that is very cool. And that is if you live in Seattle and you haven't gone and done that yet, you need to do it. It is one of the oftentimes the quote unquote tourist things don't necessarily live up to the hype of what they're built up to be. But that is one that I think is very cool and well worth your time. And if you haven't done it yet, you need to go do it. So for me, when I have people come visit, I have my kind of my standard tour that I take them on. So first off, I have a guest bus pass so that we can take the bus, because there's a great way to see the city is to like just kind of get on the transit and go, right? And of course, I hate driving and paying for parking and all that stuff. So take the bus downtown. We go to the Public Market, of course, and loop through there and go down, walk along the waterfront by the Ferris wheel and kind of that little park area there. We go to the library and take people, show them that, because the Central Library is just gorgeous.
I've actually never been there.
Oh my goodness, dude. You have to go. It's a 20-minute walk from where we are. You can take the bus right down there to the University Street Station, and it's very gorgeous. So I take them there. Now, I don't take them to the Needle. Sometimes we'll go to the Needle and like stand by it, but I actually take them to Columbia Tower,
mm-hmm.
which is the second tallest building west of Chicago. So there's one taller in San Francisco. I think it's like the Transamerica building or something like that. It's a little bit taller. But this building is twice the height of the Space Needle,
mm-hmm.
and just the ground elevation is higher. So you get up there at the top, they have a viewing observation level, and it's like $8 or $9 for students, whereas the needle's like 30 something or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no line, and you get up there, and you're just towering over the needle. It's very, very cool. And it's a beautiful view. You get up and you can look at it, and it's quiet. And so that's where I take people to go. And of course, we take them to the Troll. But what I've found is that Seattle really is not a tourist city.
No, it's
in
built
fact,
for people who live here.
It's built for people who live here. I can take people on my tour in and after. And my buddy here, we only had a few hours to go do tourist stuff. And we did most of that stuff in an hour or two. What I found is that Seattle is a place that you want to go visit if you have a friend who lives there.
Mm-hmm.
The things that, to me, the highlights of Seattle are the people that live there, especially the people that I get to interact with, and the places that you go, the bars and the coffee shops and the restaurants and the neighborhoods. And that's really where the charm of Seattle. Seattle is a great city to live in. There's all sorts of cool things going on. And so if you're going to visit... If you want to visit, you should definitely go if you know somebody who lives there.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just not going to be nearly as fun as you'd think.
Right. Yeah, I think if you have somebody coming by to visit and you can actually show them a day in the life of,
mm-hmm.
you know, what you do and where you go, it's really, like, I remember one friend when he came and visited, I took him down to the market, the public market.
Yeah.
We bought salmon.
Yeah.
I took that back and we picked up a good bottle of wine on the way. And then in the evening, like, I just ended up making this awesome salmon fillet, and it was fresh. It was a fresh salmon fillet.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it was a super laid back weekend. You know, we kind of just hung out and watched TV and caught up and stuff. And then we went out to the bars and just did one of my circuits. And the next morning we actually went down and got coffee. So it was like a very laid back, chill weekend.
Yeah.
And it's something that a lot of Seattleites do, but we kind of take it for granted. Like, this is something that I expect to happen every day, but I forget that in different parts of different states, you don't quite get to do that all the time, you know?
No, definitely not. And the charm of Seattle is in its people and its neighborhoods, and getting to experience that, I think, is really, really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun. I mean, it was great having one of my buddies here. We've been friends since middle school, and, you know, it's always fun to reminisce of old times and stuff, but it's just cool to see Seattle, and people just always get a kick out of it here. One of my friends was asking, she's talking to my friend Evan who was visiting. She said, you know, are you coming just to visit or to potentially, you know, look at moving? He said, well, you know, originally I just came out to go see, to hang out with Nick and, you know, be on vacation. He was on spring break. He said, but now that I'm here, I'm thinking that this might be a city worth coming and parking at.
Uh-huh.
It's like, that's really cool. I mean, that's what you want the city. You want the city to draw people in and to be able to say, this is a place that I could see myself, like, being a part of.
Yeah, it's really cool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think a lot of quintessential... where was I going to go with this? Well, I guess the point I wanted to make is that a lot of tourists, you can identify tourists because they carry umbrellas. A lot
mm-hmm.
of Seattleites do not carry umbrellas.
Yes, that's very true.
Although a few do here and there just to kind of be a rebel. But usually that's how you pick out a tourist in Seattle.
Or they're from Vancouver, because everybody carries umbrellas in Vancouver.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
Not any of that.
I did not understand that at all, but I don't know. That's Canada.
That's true.
Canada. Oh, man. Okay. Well, have you ever heard of this 2048 game? I've been addicted to it all week.
You know, you mentioned it real briefly. What on earth is 2048?
It's just like, it's kind of a binary game. You know how with binary numbers, if you can go from 2 to 4 to 8 to 16.
You mean base 2 numbers?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, base 2. I call it binary. Apologies.
1001 1101 0001.
Yeah.
But base 2, right. Base 2 numbers, right. Okay.
Right. So, and you get this kind of, this grid of 4x4, like, slots and blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And you move around the number 2 up until you, you know, find 2 adjacent 2s, and then you combine them together, you make a 4. And then you keep doing this. You start out with 2s, and you keep combining these blocks to make bigger and bigger numbers. And the goal is to get to 2048 before you run out of space.
Okay.
So it takes a little bit of ingenuity to do that and get there. Although I've gotten high scores, but I haven't actually beat the game yet.
Okay.
But I've been thinking recently that it might not be beatable because you might need... I mean, 2048 is 2 to the power of 11. And we only have 16 blocks, and I don't know if you can, like, maneuver the numbers around with the remaining blocks. Like, you only have 5 blocks left to maneuver around and get to the other, you know, 1024 to make that 248. So it's like a funny, I don't know, I think it might not be beatable.
Interesting.
And even, like, I guess some guy made an AI version of this game, like, to actually keep trying to beat the game, and it still hasn't gotten to a solution yet. It hasn't converged. So it just might be one of those games that you keep playing and playing and playing, but you never beat because it just can't be beaten.
Interesting.
Which would be, like, an evil genius thing to do.
It would be an evil genius thing to do. It makes me be infuriating.
Yeah.
Now, is this hosted up on GitHub, then?
It is. This is some guy... Okay.
So it's open source?
Yeah, absolutely and completely. You can check out the code.
And you can donate Bitcoins.
Yep. Yeah, a lot of programmers now, instead of asking for, like, PayPal donations, they ask for Bitcoin donations instead.
Interesting. I had a very interesting experience with Bitcoin last week.
Do tell.
Well, actually, it was with Ars Coin. So Ars Technica created their own query, or their own currency called Ars Coin, and they set it up. It had no monetary value, but there was a store that you could go to and buy things like a gold username or hats to put on your usernames or whatever. So I desperately wanted that gold username because it's awesome. Even though I didn't even have an Ars Technica account, I created one. I'm on there all the time, but I never comment, so I kind of left it. And now as they're going through, they're talking about different ways that you can start up. There's a lot of programs. There's like CPU Miner and CUDA Miner and all this stuff that basically you just tell it where your pool is and it goes out and generates the coins for you. And they specifically said that since this has no monetary value, right, don't try and, like, just run it onto your computer and let it generate, right? But I'm a graduate student, so I get to do silly and stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
So I spun up a 10-node EC2 cluster on their big GPU instances, and using StarCluster and SGE, so the Sun Grid Engine, I was able to spin up a really powerful system and just spread the jobs out and start crunching through mining these things. And I think it cost me something like $2 or $3 an hour. So, and I ended up running it for like 24 hours. So it's a lot more money than I thought it was going to. In fact, so this account that I was using is mostly just use it to store some files on S3, maybe test something every now and then. So my normal bill is like $1 or something like that. But now when I spun this thing up, AWS called me and said, "Hey, is this, we see an increase under your account. Like, is this normal?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yeah, of course. Okay, it is." But they were kind of, they thought I'd been, that my account had been hacked and people were, you know, mining Bitcoins or something. Yeah. So anyway, so I did it. I got the gold username. I was churning out something like, so most computers will do 60,000 hashes per second. So they'll check 60,000 hash combinations. And my cluster was putting out about almost 4 million.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was beastly. It was churning along really fast. It actually was not nearly as fast as anybody. If you're running, so a common way to mine these Bitcoins is to use GPUs to run all these calculations. And you can churn out a lot of hashes. So I was using it on AWS, but I think because you're basically virtualizing not only a machine but also GPUs as well, that your performance, your maximum performance is much lower than it would be if it was running any other like way. So
right, you know, this whole Bitcoin thing and Ars Coin and Dogecoin and, you know, all the other coins that are out there now,
yeah,
it got me kind of thinking about like how that actually translates to currency. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard the saying, time equals money.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think Bitcoin might actually, or Ars Coin, because we're basically computing things to mine those coins.
Mm-hmm.
And the faster you mine, the more money you get. It has not really broken away from that paradigm. In a sense, we've gone off the gold standard, but now our standard is kind of time or productivity. It's kind of an interesting idea. Like, are you getting what I'm trying to say here?
A little bit. Maybe you try and elaborate
more,
a little bit.
The more you mine, like the more computational power you use, the more efficiency you have in mining, and the mm-hmm. more coin you actually mine. So you've turned efficiency or time into the currency.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
And Bitcoin is kind of just like it's like the dollar.
Yeah.
But really, you're sort of trading time.
Well, so Bitcoin is interesting. All these coins are interesting because they have to the currency starts with nothing.
Right.
And then you're actually generating the currency that gets utilized. So you're basically the first coin that you generate, because these cryptographic computations, they like converge. So there's like a limited, there's a finite number of coins that will ever be in circulation. So the first coin that you generate theoretically contains all the value of that currency.
Mm-hmm.
So Bitcoin is like, what? I think the market cap is like $3 billion or something like that. And so...
Is that right now? There's $3 billion in Bitcoin right now?
Something like that. So it's worth right now, it's about $7 billion. It's worth about $7 billion US dollars. No, 13 billion US dollars right now. I think that's what it is. Nope, it's fallen. So that's the thing. You look at these currency fluctuations and you're just like, oh my gosh. So it's at about $8 billion right now. So theoretically, like, the first Bitcoin was worth, if you abstract out, would be worth $8 billion. And then you add a second one and you have that value. And then you continuously, so you're dividing it all up.
Well, where did that $5 billion go? $5 billion is not a small amount of money.
No, so it's diversified. So as each person now owns, as I own two Bitcoins or whatever, that is worth two out of however many coins are in existence. That's worth, you know, take the total value, divide it by the number of coins in existence, multiply by two, right? And that's how many I have. That's not what my value is. And so that's actually one of the interesting things about Bitcoin is that it's not nearly as like diverse as you would think that it would be. So I think the Winklevoss twins, you know, the people that like from The Social Network that like helped, like they had the idea for Facebook first or whatever.
Sure.
So they own like something like 30% of the Bitcoins in existence. So they basically control like the currency. And that currency valuation is based on the ability to move it in and out of real dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So they have, with 30%, they can move that back. You can do like micro currency transactions where you're like moving it back and forth into US and out of US dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And they can basically control this market. Like the market valuation is, they could just flood everything, like flood the market on either end and totally manipulate the valuation here. So there's another great really interesting article on the idea of collusion. So you have to verify these cryptographic trades transactions, because there's basically a giant public record that keeps track of like all of who transferred money back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, like the pool of workers like has to verify these transactions, and the number of transactions that they verify, they get rewarded a certain number of Bitcoins, and these pools like will hand that out, and it's like 20 or something like that per the pool gets 20 like for every block of transactions that it processes, and then you get a percentage of that. So, but there's no reason why it has to be set at 20. That's just kind of like the agreed upon thing. And so there's only a few of these pools out in existence, and so they can basically say, you know what, we're going to give ourselves 50, we're going to award 50 Bitcoins, and say we're going to award 50 instead of the normal 20 or something. And so they can actually do like price fixing.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically Bitcoin is supposed to be like impervious to all this stuff, because you're basically, you have the incentive for the other person not to screw you by saying that you transferred more money. So you like the open public record helps verify those transactions and stuff, but there's nothing to keep the reward for verifying transactions at a set level.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, in order for Bitcoin to become a currency, it would become a means of conveying valuance and market value, it has to fall under the same rules that other currencies do. So in a sense, Bitcoin really doesn't provide you any additional benefits from a fiat currency.
Wow.
It just decentralizes it now. Or not decentralizes it. It just simply takes it away from these banks and these things that people don't understand to now these pools of money, which people understand, but that doesn't mean that they can control.
Right. Really interesting.
Yeah.
The Winklevoss twins. Man, I keep hearing about these guys. I've never seen The Social Network, although everyone tells me I should go see it. I still have not seen that movie. So maybe if you know off the top of your head like what they are famous for besides...
Rowing champions.
Oh, okay. And I guess they must be Ivy Leaguers.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. They're like yeah. American rowers and internet entrepreneurs, Cameron and Tyler. They claim nearly 1%. Okay, so in 2013, they claim they own nearly 1% of all Bitcoins in existence at that time. So not nearly as much as I thought, but still 1% is...
You know, can't you just mine for Bitcoins?
You can. It's very, very difficult to do.
And can't you scale up on Amazon with AWS to a certain point where you make more money than you spend?
Well, Bitcoin's really hard because there's so much power being thrown because they're so far down the chain. So as you like move through like as you move through time, the like computations get more and more and more complex, mm-hmm. and your computer gets like a difficulty setting based on. So you do get benefit from GPUs, but you also get assigned harder work because it's based on. That one's not based on S-Crypt, but anyways, I don't understand all the details and it's kind of funky. But yeah, so now you have to basically use ASICs like. Specific FPGAs to do this. Otherwise, you're just not going to. So, like Butterfly Labs generates has a product, mm-hmm. and they generate five giga hashes per second. Whereas again, so my computer was generating 3.8 mega hashes per second.
Wow! So 5 giga hashes.
On a box that's like, you know, that sits on a desk. Right. So there's just no way that you can actually like go like really run that on your own machines and stuff. So that's why a lot of people move to like, so these new currencies like Dogecoin and stuff are appealing because they, because you can get in earlier and you can like generate more money faster and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it just, yeah, it's, I don't know. It's a mess. And it's all based upon the same principles of general currency in that it's what people have agreed upon the transaction rates to be. It doesn't necessarily, so it's supposed to be built upon the fact that you can't just generate more. There's a finite number. It's built upon the same principles as Somalia's currency.
Mm-hmm.
And Somalia has the most stable currency in the world. However, that doesn't mean they can buy anything with it.
I'm looking at this right now. You can get a 10 giga hash per second. A Bitcoin miner for $350.
Yeah.
And you can get one that makes 300 giga hashes per second for 1500.
Yeah.
Or 600 giga hashes for 2200. It's insane. So I mean, I guess how much would that translate to per month of money, do you think, if we had,
so
let's just say 10 giga hashes.
I'm going to go back to my friends at Ars Technica.
Mm-hmm.
And so they did this. They actually got one of those the older model, the 5 gigahertz from Butterfly Labs, and they looked at it and said that, let me see what their total thing was. But basically, it did make them money.
Wow.
So they were generating, based on the exchange rates.
Because right now, if you think about it, like the Fed basically dictates currency, and it's very centralized.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of decentralized currency mechanism might be something that puts more power into the hands of the people as opposed to a centralized unit. But is that a good thing or a bad thing? I just don't know.
All right, hold on. Let me look at this. Yeah, it's not nearly as simple as that type of thing. The other thing that you want in a currency is stability, right?
Right.
You want a currency to be stable, and this is not stable. And it may very well trend towards that, but... The benefits that people are talking about aren't necessarily the way that you really want it. It's great for like libertarian and anarchists to kind of look at. But all that you're doing is instead of having one central bank that is working with lots of other central banks in order to like trade value back and forth and like maintain stability and do other things like prop up markets and provide protections in case things like go south. All Bitcoin is doing is saying instead of doing this, we're going to go to these five or six like. Instead of having one central bank, we're going to have like five or six people that, but again, they're not regulated, so they totally have the ability to like collude and do all this
and
crap,
manipulate.
Right? So Chase and Wells Fargo are legally prohibited from like toying with people's currencies and crap like that. And there's limits on like high-speed frequency trading and high-frequency trading and stuff like that.
So you would think that those companies would be very interested in Bitcoin and they would be interested in making this currency happen because it would be in their benefit because they could manipulate it.
Chase said, no, this doesn't provide any value. We have no interest in this.
Chase said that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they released a report. Let's see. Let me find it. Oh, gosh.
What about Citibank or Bank of America? I think right now it provides no value, but...
Well, the point, like, it's not just Chase that was like, oh, like, they're... they said it's a terrible, terrible store of value. And their head of emerging markets was like, this doesn't provide any benefits over fiat currency. And there's like, yeah, so I read the article like a while ago. I don't remember all their arguments. But basically, they're like, we don't care about this.
Mm-hmm.
This can't store value. It has no, like, no benefit in investment, right? There doesn't have to be any transparency. Oh yeah, we have a public like transaction record and stuff like that. But it's much more difficult for done. It's just as difficult to understand, I think, as money. So,
right. I'm looking up right now how many gigahashes. 10 gigahashes to dollars. I wonder if Google can do that. GHS. No, it's giving me that GHS is like the Ghana CD apparently. The Ghanaian currency, uh-huh. Not the country in Africa.
Yeah.
Either way, I looked it up later and report back. Maybe we'll just post it on the,
the
blog.
So ours said that their 5 gigahertz machine cost them combined, took 28 kilowatts of electricity, which based on this reporter was $3.68. And it generated 2 bitcoins, which at the time were, this was in June 2013, was worth about $700.
Wow.
So, and the machine costs about $350.
Yeah.
So, it is worthwhile. Now, of course, the value of that is going to decrease over time because you're going to generate fewer and fewer coins because there's going to the blocks are going to get, like, bigger or however. I don't remember exactly how it works, but it's not going to be nearly as a, like, that's going to decrease over time. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons why Bitcoin is less appealing for people to get into right now in mining because it just takes so much computational power to, like, and the pools are so big that it's like so that your payout's so small and all this kind of stuff.
So what that would mean is you want to use the system early, and yep. Then at a certain point you get diminishing returns, and that's when you want to unplug it mm-hmm. and maybe sell that system and get a new one because a new system won't be registered.
It doesn't work on registered. It works on like when you run this thing, it like figures out like there's like a difficulty hash, so the code like checks your machine and like. I don't remember exactly how it all works, but mm-hmm. like Scrypt and Bcrypt, these algorithms, they have a work function, right? So they're designed for cryptographic systems that you can say, okay, now that there's been a comparable increase in computing power, so we just want to up the work function in order to like make sure that our cryptographic hashes are just magically stronger now.
Right.
Just like more turns of the dial or whatever. So, so it's just not... So that's why we're seeing a proliferation of all these currencies. As people are like jumping in on the ground floor, they can generate a bunch, and because it's like because it has no real value or enough tied to anything, it's easy enough to say that this is that the valuation's at $10 million. Well, I control 3% of that, right? Mm-hmm. So now I'm sitting there at $300,000 or whatever.
Yep, that's the difference between paper money.
$30,000. But yeah, so I mean, it's same. Oh well, we need to go right. So this isn't cross of gold, right? We don't need to like tie ourselves back to this. We don't need to tie ourselves back to the gold standard, but it's the same as anything. The further and further that you divorce away from any sort of real valuation, they say, oh, it's based on a mathematical concepts, right? Okay, mm-hmm. fine. So we're credit default swaps. Like, we have the mathematics to prove it, just nobody can understand it. And it just, you're continually moving and moving away from the mechanisms of markets, which is production and consumption. And the more you move away from that, the easier it is to just increase leverage and increase, quote unquote, valuation. But you're still not creating anything that's really a better store of value or anything that's better in the long run.
Cool.
Yeah. So there we go. So that's a Bitcoin. So that's my like kind of Bitcoin rant for, and I still need to like dig all the way into like figure out what all is happening. But
I think I'm gonna start saving up for one of these butterfly machines, at least the entry level one, just to kind of toy with it and play with it and see what I can do with it.
Yeah.
Although it's probably not gonna be worth it. So let's just see.
All right. Well, so that was my rant. Now, do you want to do your rant or do you want to move on? You have a rant on here. It specifically says rant.
Yeah, I do. I do have. So this kind of is a, you know, we had a bunch of new students come by and talk to us about what we like about Seattle and why we go to school here.
Yeah, we had all our prospective students.
Yep, all the puppies.
All the puppies. I prefer to call them the babies.
The babies.
It's more adorable. I like babies better than puppies.
I don't know, man.
I probably shouldn't say that out
loud. I think I like puppies more than like babies. But that's just okay. Me.
That's probably a safer, legally a safer position to take. But, you know, whatever.
But, yeah. So, you know, one of the people, she asked me why I moved from Silicon Valley in San Francisco, you know, out to Seattle. And,
yeah.
Like, that, because that basically is, like, the utopia is, you know, the way that she's painted it. Like, Silicon Valley is awesome. There's a lot of startups there. And it's, like, you can, you know, basically be a millionaire overnight if you play your cards right. And my answer to that, it kind of ended up being a rant. But what I wanted to share was that a lot of things, so a lot of professors, whether you're at Stanford or UC Berkeley or UCSF or whatever, even Southern California, like a number of professors, they get money from the government to do research, right? And
mm-hmm.
grants from nonprofits and stuff. So they take that and then they basically make sure that they give admission to the smart kids, the kids who would help them build a company or, you know, will be great as a CEO. So imagine you're a professor, and then you basically get a team of 5 or 6 brilliant students who want to work under you and be at your school. And then you make each one the CEO of their own company, and you are the person who sits on their advisory board.
Mm-hmm.
You just need one of them to make it in Silicon Valley, and
yeah.
you'll make a couple of million because you're the advisor. And at the same time, that graduate student who is a CEO or CSO or whatever of that company also gets to be a millionaire. And all the other students, you know, they didn't get to be a millionaire, but at the same time, you know, they kind of have the connection to work at this company that they've just, that this other student has just built, and they have good experience from what they've tried to do. So it's kind of like their way of hedging all their bets on somebody else's dime and then making a ton of money off of it.
Yeah.
So it's pretty, like, it's unethical, but nobody calls anybody out on that.
Yeah.
And it's like a big business out there. That's how, you know, they make money.
Yeah.
They basically just have somebody else foot the bill, and then they get a bunch of, they prey on, prey on a bunch of smart students who want to be like the next Google founders,
yeah.
and then they basically make them do a startup that's sort of along the lines of what could become Google, but have them sell out to a big company and make a couple of million and kind
yeah.
of just retire early.
Yeah.
So some people like that, and that's a great idea, but at the same, you know, and it's, I can see the appeal, definitely. I mean, I wanted to do that myself at one point, but
yeah.
the, somehow it just feels unethical.
Yeah.
And a lot of people find it distasteful.
Yeah.
So myself included.
That's, that's really interesting. Yeah, I think there is a perspective. So Seattle oftentimes gets compared to, you know, to San Francisco, as we have an interesting and unique culture. And so it's always like, oh, it's better. Do you like SF or Seattle better? And I've spent just a little bit of time in Seattle or in SF. But you can't get I mean, being in the industry that we're in, you can't get away from it. And there's always, it seems like every day you're finding something that somebody else is doing or reference of a new startup that's going to like revolutionize something. And
mm-hmm.
and so for me, being an outsider, you know, I look in on it and I have a few issues. One of it is this obsession with disruption.
Yeah.
So there's an idea that because something has been around for a while that it's worth disrupting. And it may be, but that's not a good enough reason to justify that. And so that's just kind of silly. Instead of asking the question of how can we make this better, the question is just how can we disrupt this? How can we apply? We'll just put it on a web client or something like that. On you're like, I don't know if that's necessarily a great idea, but okay.
Mm-hmm.
There is another issue is this. We got really angry at Wall Street during in 2006, 2008 because they were able to create these financial products that were totally devoid from, again, market dynamics, right?
Yep.
And but how is Silicon Valley any different?
It's not. It's
so there
not
was an announcement. So I saw an article. I need to find it. That Twitter they bought 2 log cabins in Montana, disassembled them, shipped them to their headquarters, and built them into their cafeteria.
But why?
To increase to bring nature inside, increase increase worker happiness and like creativity and all this stuff. And we'll get back to that whole thing in a second. But what was interesting was there was this line in there that said Twitter has never turned a profit.
Well, you know,
now I have a friend, and we talked about it before, Nate Jones. He's
mm-hmm.
Cafeology. They make the S filter. Last week they announced that they are now equity positive. That they have now made more money than they have put into the company.
Which means they've made more money than Twitter ever has.
Yes, which means that, yes, they have made, Nate Jones has made more money than Twitter has.
But with that being
now,
said,
now, granted, they were 2 weeks away from, they had to go another week or two before they caught the rate of inflation. But still, the fact is that they have contributed a net positive to the world. They have generated wealth. Twitter has not generated wealth. They have just spread wealth around.
Right, but at the same time, maybe Twitter is not, like, maybe the sort of dollar valuation of Twitter is not reflective of the value it conveys to people. Like, I think a lot of people use Twitter, and there's a lot of maybe cash flow, but it might not be turning a profit in the same way that Amazon doesn't turn a profit all the time.
Amazon does turn a profit. They have razor-thin margins, but they turn a profit. And Jeff chases that profit. Apple turns a profit. Google turns a profit. Facebook does not. Facebook makes, like, I think they made, like, their profit was like $50 million last year on a billion users. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like infinitesimally small. Twitter does not make a profit. WhatsApp, I think actually WhatsApp did make a little bit of money. But there's this total divorce from, it's not unrealistic. I mean, the financial industry's been able to get away with this for a while. Russia, I mean, the Russian debt crisis in 89 or whenever it was. I mean, Spain was doing that. I mean, sovereign entities get to do this. The federal government gets to do this. But it's frustrating in that most industries, they punish people for not making a profit. Like, you can't just spend money and get more money infused in. Twitter, it requires cash infusions every year to stay solvent.
Well, who's funding it? The market people? Like the people who buy shares, basically?
Basically. The IPO gave them a huge influx of cash. And then they open up another couple rounds of VC funding. I mean, that's what a third round is.
So, you know, if Twitter just bought back, I mean, how many shares of Twitter does Twitter actually own?
That's a really good question. Because if they can't buy any back, I don't think they have cash. So they have to sell more shares in order to get more money.
But usually if they own most of the shares of their own company, they can, to a degree, control the value of that stock.
Yeah, because they can either buy it back to increase control or sell it to raise cash. Mm-hmm. And so they probably control a large chunk of their shares, which allows them to borrow. So what they can do is they can borrow from, they basically get cash from banks.
Yeah.
Because the increase of their valuation is increasing at the rate at which they is less than the rate of growth of their stock. So when their stock goes down, they basically can collateralize on their stock and their stock returns. But when that goes down, then all of a sudden they're negative valuation and then their debts get called in.
Yeah, it feels like another financial crisis waiting to happen.
It's the same thing with markets.
Is going to burst. Yeah.
What's interesting is they looked at, when the last bubble in like 2001, they looked at a bunch of these companies and they found out that these companies were selling services to each other. So they were just trading money in a circle.
That's basically what's happening in San Francisco right now, I would say. It's just like there's a startup for every startup.
Yeah, basically.
And there's a startup to help people using that startup. So yeah. it's like, I don't know, man. It just seems very fishy.
It is fishy. It's not unusual, right? I mean, the steel industry has done this kind of stuff. Like the auto. I mean, every industry does stuff like this.
And you have all these incubators that are kind of propping all these companies up.
And it's continual infusion of cash. So the SEC calls, in a sense, they call some of this, it resembles a Ponzi scheme.
It definitely is a Ponzi scheme.
So now this is not to say that there aren't lots of brilliant people there,
mm-hmm.
Doing interesting things. And like, and
they
really
have great intentions.
Yeah, and they go in there and they create really cool stuff. Interestingly enough, I think I saw the last census, Seattle has more software developers than SF does.
Wow, is that because of Microsoft?
Microsoft Amazon? And Amazon, and I mean, Boeing, mm-hmm. There's a lot of software engineers. And there's just a lot of other places. I mean, UW, there's just lots of places that have a lot of developers.
I heard that Portland, Oregon actually has the most iOS programmers in the world.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's probably true. That makes sense.
You would think Cupertino or the Bay Area, but no, it's Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. So anyways, that's frustrating as somebody who, and especially I'm frustrated for my friends that have to play in kind of quote unquote the normal market space. You get really frustrated. So my dad's company has $350 million in revenue, or no, they're a little over 400 now. The third largest in their industry in the US. And they're hiring like 20 people this year, right? So Zynga has 2,000 employees.
Ozinga is something that we kind of, as Seattleites, just try to forget about.
Yeah. So you look at this and you say, like, they are on this huge growth trajectory. They're growing huge. And their growth rate is less than, like, these little tiny companies. Nobody's going to buy them for $16 billion. Like, and yet, and they have to, and part of that is because they have to grow at the rate at which they're, you know, because their insurance, their premium growth is. And, like, all of this kind of stuff. There's these market dynamics that they have to play with that what makes that other entities and industries don't have to deal with. So part of me is kind of like, angry, but... And then I think the last thing, if we were talking about, to finish off this rant, we were talking about Twitter and their log cabins. One of the things that SF has done really, really, really well, and not just them and a lot of other places, is that they have done something that other organizations and industries have been trying to pull off for years, and that they have fundamentally reoriented the social relationship from community and family to the company. Bravo to them. We haven't been able to see industries do that since the coal days in West Virginia.
What do you mean by? Oh, so you mean like basically the community revolves around the company.
Google does not want you to leave.
Right.
They want you to be there from breakfast to dinner and even longer. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting a lot of flack right now with like the buses and stuff like the buses that like those things and. Taking people out of their communities and moving them into these campuses. Facebook is building apartments now for their employees, mm-hmm. which is interesting. When they look at it, only of like 300 units, 20 or 30 of them are more than one bedroom. And when you look at the amenities and things, it's very clearly oriented towards young 20-year-old like male programmers. And you just look at that and you say, like, this is not healthy from this kind of standpoint, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Google and Twitter's idea, they talk about they want to foster these creative environments and stuff, but really what they're trying to say is that we just want you to be more productive, right?
Yep.
And companies got in trouble. There's this lawsuit for like you can't put things in the air anymore. They used to put like peppermint and stuff in there, increased productivity, and they got like sued out the snaz for that.
That was a thing.
Oh yeah, that was a thing because like peppermint like increases mindset, and like other places would pump more oxygen into rooms. Like they casinos do that to like.
Well, casinos have to with all the cigarette
right,
smoke
right.
and.
Like, well, that. Yeah, but also it's like this idea of like it increases happiness and euphoria and stuff like that. So I was an EMT in Indiana, and we would like our standard routine was you come up to somebody, you just put them on oxygen.
Why is it illegal? I mean,
because you were like manipulating people, and so you like couldn't modify like the environment. So I'll have to see if I can find some of those cases, but yeah, they used to do like subliminal messaging, right, in television.
Mm-hmm.
You used to put one frame, per second would be like a Coke bottle, and you can't do that anymore. Like, so how is what Google and Twitter are doing any different, right? And it's also well because it is different. It's also a way to flout to get around income law, tax laws.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's like a non-taxable work benefit stuff.
Right.
Which interestingly, both my dad and I tried to come up with ways to do that for his employees and then for the students at my undergrad,
mm-hmm.
and both of us got very nice letters from the tax attorneys saying this is a felony. You can't do that.
Wow.
So in my household, coming up with a tax evasion scheme is sort of like a rite of passage. So,
right.
Now, of course, I just want to say we definitely did not go through with them.
Mm.
Dang it. But, you know, that's basically what they're doing is a tax evasion scheme.
Mm-hmm.
So you increase compensation with the non-monetary benefits, and then you can just write it all off. So, and that's why, like, Boeing this year, they had the government paid them, like, $53 million or something for, you know, getting taxes back and stuff. And, you know, these companies, they don't pay taxes. That's why they're all headquartered in Delaware and Florida and stuff. So
mm-hmm.
anyways, so there's all of that. And again, there's lots of really awesome and brilliant people in SF, but there's also very much a culture that at least from an outsider, you look at it and you say, I'm just not really interested in being a part of that.
Exactly.
So anyways, moving on. So let's talk some more about software. You've got a few things on here. What are you using iTerm now? Is that right?
Yeah, I started to use iTerm too. It was actually your tip. Yeah, I've kind of I haven't been too pleased with it. Yeah.
How dare you?
Well, here's the thing. I haven't found any functionality in there that doesn't already exist in like the built-in terminal application on the Mac.
What about history?
I guess maybe I haven't been using those features. What is history?
Like the ability to like, iTerm or terminal is like, if you type in a command, like, it doesn't always, like, you can't, like, completion is weird, and moving between lines is, like, see, it like, you have to, like, hit the, you have to, like, hit, like, the function keys or whatever, and, like, there is stuff, like, it does, oh, it doesn't save, so if I open up terminal again, if I open up terminal again, my command history is, like, I think it's, like, wiped out or something. It's just, like, it's just clunky and awful, and the text is really gross, and, like.
Have you typed in history?
Well, yeah, well, it keeps that history, but, like, it wouldn't, it doesn't, like, save commands across different, across sessions and stuff like that, yeah. I mean, of course, like, the history, like, history works, but it's just, like, clunkier and, like, doesn't replace well and all this weird crap, so.
Right. I don't know. I think maybe I've been using Terminal on Mac long enough that I've kind of overcome those annoyances, but.
Well, for me, what it was switching back and forth between my Linux boxes and then OS X. I would always just, OS, like, Terminal was just, like, awful. It felt like, you know, command prompt on Windows, so I switched to Terminal to get a more consistent layout, so.
Yeah, I mean, I've been using it, and I've been enjoying it, but at the same time, I just don't know if I'm going to stick with it, because it just seems like I'm not getting too much value out of it, and it's just one more thing to have on my computer, like, one more application I have to, like, update and maintain and stuff, so I'm going to give it a go for maybe about a month, and if I don't think it's giving me any value, I'm just going to cut the cord.
All right.
But so far, it seems like, I think maybe if you are, you know, like you, and you work across Unix and Mac, and whatever else, you know, I guess Windows as well, maybe iTerm is definitely useful and consistent. But for me, I just don't think it's doing it.
All right. Well, that's fair enough. So, but of course, you're still rocking the Bash. Now, have you ever toyed with any other, like, terminal environments? Like, what is it? So we have Bash and Zish, is that how you pronounce it? Z-S-C-H?
Z-Shell? I don't know.
Yeah, or Fish. Have you ever worked with Fish?
I've never heard of Fish.
Fish is like this funky language. It's like, their website's so funny. Like, it says, like, finally, a command shell for the 90s.
Oh, good God.
It's, like, hilarious. Like, I've never used it, because we talk about, like, again, the idea of anti-fragility. If I become super awesome with, like, Fish, then what does that mean when I try and, like, write some code? So it has, like, better scripting and stuff than just, like, straight Bash. But then, like, you have to, like, make sure that terminal is installed somewhere. You pull up another command line. You're like, wait, what? Where am I?
Anti-fragility. I mean, I like the concept and stuff, but at the same time, it seems like if you're sort of make the effort to make yourself very anti-fragile, you never get good at anything. You never, like, completely optimize.
But I don't have to. But the principle of anti-fragility is that I don't have to be, like, the best at something. I just have to not be the worst at it, because that's where all of your time is going to be spent. It's like, as soon as you move across something, you're going to, like, as soon as that bad thing happens, like, your whole system falls apart, your productivity hits the floor, and then you lose all of, basically, you, like, lose all of that time that you saved other places. And it's not that Bash isn't, like, it's not that I'm not great at, like, Bash or something, but do the benefits, and there are things where you say the benefits that I'm gaining here are better than what I'm giving up.
Right.
No, but I don't know if shell, like you were talking about iTerm, are the benefits of what I get using iTerm higher than, like, than the cost of maintaining an extra piece of software and maybe learning the little funky things there.
Right.
So, for me, I just think that iTerm adds a bunch of parity back into it, and, like, the command sequences are more like other things. So adding iTerm, even though I had to maintain an extra platform, it enables it that I can, or an extra program, I can move across platforms a lot easier.
I know I'm kind of being a naysayer today, but that's exactly the reason why I didn't learn Emacs, because I felt like it's just not worth learning with all the features and benefits that they kind of market to
people. But that's because Emacs is, like, funkalicious.
It is, but, you know, I've seen people who are amazing with Emacs, and they're great with it, but then they go to Vim, and they just have no idea what they're doing. And I'm, like, the opposite. I love Vim. Like, that's like, my jam. But at the same time, if you put Emacs in front of me, I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
So.
No, I mean, that's the same. I think I dinked around with Emacs a little bit, but I finally sat down and, like, learned Vim about a year ago, And I use that all the time. And I love Vim, especially Mac Vim.
Yeah.
Mac Vim is awesome because you get a little bit of a GUI. You can do it kind of bridges that gap a little bit. And I know the Vim purists are like, oh, it's supposed to be designed to be used without a mouse. But you know what? Screw them. Mm-hmm. So this is 2020. This is 2014. I almost forgot what year it was. So, and I get to do that. So I use Vim for everything. And have you used, what is it? Janus? J-A-N-U-S?
No,
it has a bunch of like, it's like a collection of awesome packages that add things like line numbers and like better highlighting and things on.
Oh, on Mac.
File explorers on Vim, which then translate to Mac. Well, Mac Vim, it reads that the Vim RC, but Mac Vim has some of its own kind of stuff. So. Mm-hmm.
No, I think I use Vim just for like very quick one-off type things. Mm-hmm. If I just am so lazy that I don't want to fire up a text editor.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I use Sublime Text. So Vim is like my, I'm lazy, I don't want to do this, I just want to get this done quickly, just like a one-line deletion or whatever. I don't mm-hmm. want to, you know, take the time.
Oh, but dude, DD, right? Done.
Otherwise.
D5D, done.
Exactly. Otherwise, it's just Sublime Text because they have a bunch of cool features.
I need to start using. So I've been thinking about using Sublime. Sell me on Sublime. If I can't sell you on iTerm, you sell me on Sublime.
Well, there's a bunch of syntax highlighting. They support macros. You can automate things. A lot of the stuff you can do in Vim, you can also do in Sublime.
Okay.
You can set up the hotkeys as well, if you'd like to do that. So you can basically turn Sublime into Mac Vim.
Okay.
If you want to do that. They have all sorts of cool features like block commenting and uncommenting, and there's function completion or text completion as well. So if you're programming and if it knows you're doing JavaScript and it has access to that JavaScript library you're working with, if you press tab, it'll give you function completion.
Oh, magic.
Yeah.
Supposedly NodeClips is supposed to do that, but it doesn't.
It also, you can actually use a console from inside Sublime Text. And the source code's up on GitHub. You can just download it and compile it for free.
Yeah, I do have, I think I have Sublime 3 on here, but I just don't use it.
You can save workspaces. You can integrate Git with it, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of also mirror that onto your Evernote or your Dropbox or whatever you like to use. So it's, you know, and the source code's available, so you can go through it. Basically, they ask you to register, but you don't have to. But there's been a lot of controversy about that. Like, as a grad student, maybe you should register it because you use it a lot, but at the same time, we're grad students, so...
We don't have a lot of money.
Yeah, and licenses, you know, they cost quite a lot. So I think Sublime is reasonable, though. It's like, what, $50 for a license?
I'm looking at it right now. I think it's 70.
70.
Yeah. I mean, again, if it's something you use every day, it's not a matter. And we like paying for good software, right? But
mm-hmm.
that's a lot of money right now.
It is.
I mean, that's like two Chemexes.
It is. It is.
So, you know, you got to have your thing. But yeah, so I've been looking at Sublime. The other one that I've used is TextMate. And so they're working on TextMate like 2, but it doesn't. I can't get it to. You can never get it to compile. But I like TextMate. That's a really good one as well. And you have, what is Coda?
Oh, Coda is a Mac-specific code editor. Specifically designed for the web.
Oh, my Panic.
Yes.
I love Panic. They have great software.
I think they might be like WebStorm, but like for Mac. So I haven't quite used Coda too much, but I've toyed around with it, and it seems like it's pretty cool software. I use Transmit by Panic. And it's like hands down, I would say, the best FTP program for Mac.
Yeah. The other one that's really good is CyberDuck.
Okay.
It's free. And also really awesome. No, I think you're right. I think Transmit, I've used it a little bit. It's amazing. But I use...
Ooh, what is that stuff? I've never seen the other programs.
That yeah. So I use, but I use CyberDuck because it's free. So they have this new thing called Status Board, which lets you like define a whole bunch of metrics and things and feeds and stuff. And it basically lets you create like a status board that plugs into different things. And it's designed to be projected on put up on a TV. So you can stream it to AirPlay and put it out, or put it up on an iPad, and so it's kind of cool.
It's native Mac, I guess it is.
Yeah, I think it's native. It's iPad. It's supposed to run on an iPad, I believe.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I actually built myself an app like that when I was an undergrad, so that way I can get my things, list of things to do, plus
and
the
you
weather.
Built,
plus
you built one of those while you were at Illumina, right?
Yeah, actually, the whole manufacturing team ended up buying a big old TV and. It was built in R.
How did you do, tell me how you did this? Because you told me once, and it was like really, it was like delightfully hackalicious.
It was really ugly code. So we get these log files mm-hmm. off of instruments, And a lot of times, what we used to do is we used to see if, so before an instrument would go out, like once they manufactured them, they'd test them to make sure that they actually were up to par. And if they weren't, they'd take them back and look at what was wrong with it, because it had to meet a certain level of quality before it could be shipped, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is on the manufacturing floor, they'd test all this stuff out, but then, and we tried to automate a lot of that stuff, but it was tough to do all that. And over time, we started to figure out like what we need to look for and what we don't need to look for. So the manufacturing team was looking for like a data scientist essentially to do this for them, but then they ended up just giving like the bioinformatics team, like our team, the job to do anyway. They're just like, try and fit this in. So, you know, once we figured out what we need to look for, you know, within all these runs, like all the different metrics that people look at, I basically just took R like script and like it was like a ggplot2 thing, and I just kind of hacked it into reading the log file and then making vectors and counting them and making stats and just making one big like JPEG image. And basically each time we would, you know, the script would run every minute or 2 minutes, so it would refresh the image every time, and it was just full of bar plots and
it was an image full of things.
One image, and not on a web page. It was an image, and it was not interactable. It was just very static. But then it had every single instrument on the manufacturing floor, and all like every detail of every like thing, that they measure, on that image. So you know, and like an overall status thing. So if they have like a number of failures in a certain instrument or a certain testing area, they could sort of follow up on that and go, okay, well, it looks like everything's passing except for this, the stuff that's going through this region of the. Of the warehouse right here. So let's check this out. There might be some sort of an update that we need to do on the software or something. It also categorized like human error or technical error or, you know, system, you know, scientific error, whatever it was that we were trying to measure there. So it gave them everything that they look for, but like in one image.
Awesome.
And they ended up buying this big old like 70-inch, 80-inch TV and putting it up like on the wall and then just mounting this image up there, which would refresh every minute. So, like, everyone can just look up at the board and go, okay, well, this is where we stand right now.
Dude, that's brilliant. And I love how it was hacked R code and it just spit out an image, right? So, like, this thing, a status board of my panic, like, it's probably got a whole bunch of really cool and clever little widgets that you can load on and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
And you're just like, screw that image.
Yeah, you know, as a programmer, I do my best to, and this sounds so unambitious, not program.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Everybody wants to do that, right? That's why you have... DSLs, domain specific languages, so you just like just repeat all this crap.
It's like in soccer, like have you like, so basically if you are running around a lot and you're not passing the ball, you're gonna get tired and you're just gonna make mistakes and the ball's gonna get stolen from you. But if you pass a lot and you are running, you know, not as much as you possibly would, you can save your energy, you can make good decisions. And it's the same thing in programming. Instead of running and, you know, aka coding, you could pass the ball and try and reuse the stuff on the field to your advantage.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good. All right. Well, we are definitely done. We're a little bit over an hour now, and we've made it through. What did we make it through? Like four topics, I think. So.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. That's pretty good for us. We tend to ramble. So, anyways, all right, folks. Well, so this is the end, and next week is going to be episode 10, and we're going to have a little bit in store for you. One of the things we want to do is we want to send out a survey. We want to see if you guys get some feedback and see what people are, see what you guys are thinking about, what you like, what you don't like, and see if we can interact with some of the listeners out there and see if we can continue to improve the show. So, yeah. So anything else that you want to add, Nikhil?
Sure to follow us on Twitter at Nikhil Gopal or at Nick Robison.
Yeah.
And we also have at Informatonauts. We'd love to hear from you. So be sure to tweet us and we'll tweet you back. We go through every email we get,
that's right.
And we reply to everybody. At least now it's manageable. We don't have like a slew of people.
That's true. So please don't slew us. But yeah, feel free to reach out. And if there's a topic you wanna see covered, or if you think we've said something really silly or ignorant, then feel free to respond. And we'd love to open up the dialogue. You know, this is a learning process for us as well, to figure out what's going on in the world. So we love feedback.
And also, if you have something interesting to share and you would like to be interviewed, let us know, and
yeah,
we might be able to arrange that.
Yeah, we'd love to hear what other people are working on and the interesting things that are going on in their world. So.
Okay, well, that's pretty much all I have. So thank you guys for listening.
Yep, take care. We will see you next week.